Before I introduce tonight's speaker and program, let me first start with some thanks for folks who helped to make this possible. Several members of the staff of the Harward Center are key to the Civic Forum series. Most of all, Peggy Rotundo, who is sort of the organizer and strategist and planner of this whole series, Kristen Cloutier in our office, and Brenda Pelletier, who helped to organize the forums and make them happen. Bates Media Center gives us indispensable aid in recording the Civic Forums. And we're also grateful to MPBN, Maine Public Broadcasting Network, which plans to broadcast tonight's forum, as it does almost all our forums, on its Speaking in Maine series. And that note of thanks to MPBN reminds me, Peter Levine's talk tonight will be followed by question and answer and discussion, of course, and we hope that that'll be spirited and robust. If you ask a question, please come to me afterwards and sign a permission form so that we have your permission to broadcast your voice in the Speaking in Maine broadcast for that. We hope that that won't deter you at all, just the opposite. Now, any year is a good time to talk and think about engaged citizenship. But this election year seems especially good. On the one hand, there's a widespread view that our polity and our nation faces a crisis of citizenship. There are widespread fears of disengagement of people, of lack of participation, of low levels of voting and community affiliation, rampant privatism, a fractured, balkanized kind of politics that sets interest groups and regions and social interests against one another, all driven by a media culture that tends to trivialize and polarize public issues. And that fear of what we might call the crisis of citizenship has led over the past decade to a broad movement to renew and reactivate democratic citizenship, partly through thinking about changes in our political culture, about the way we talk and think and argue with one another, partly through new proposals to reform political institutions and political and electoral practices. That's all on the one hand, the great problem that we're living through. And on the other hand, it's striking that both candidates in this election are notable for headlining civic engagement and national service, for foregrounding them as important national commitments, although with interesting differences from between them, as the interviews they gave at the Service Nation Summit 2 weeks ago demonstrate. I can't remember another election in which issues of active citizenship and service have been more part of the conversation and on the table. It's a moment of conversation for this movement to renew, a moment of opportunity for this movement to renew citizenship. And I hope it won't be lost on the day after the election, on November 5th. I don't know anyone who's better suited to help us think about the possibilities, challenges, and hopes for renewed civic engagement now in this election time than Peter Levine. As we were publicizing this visit, I had a hard time finding succinct ways of describing Peter and his work and why he was just the right person to have here. He's a scholar advocate. He's a philosopher administrator. He's an activist policy wonk. He's a kind of study in all the contradictions that are part of this set of issues. Peter is the director of CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, now 7 or 8 year old center that began at the University of Maryland and has now moved to Tufts University, where he also serves as research director of Tufts Jonathan Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service. Peter's a graduate of Yale and Oxford, where he held a Rhodes Scholarship, and he's been for 20 years a leading voice in what I would call the democracy movement, the movement for civic renewal. He's worked for Common Cause and President Clinton's National Commission on Civic Renewal. He's written manifestos and political theory and social science reports on political participation, civic and citizenship. He's the author of several important studies of and blueprints for democratic renewal, including The Future of Democracy, Developing the Next Generation of American Citizens, and Forging Citizens Policy for Youth Civic Engagement, along with books of moral philosophy, two novels, and a long poem on the internet. He is a rare set of combinations, in my view, a truly public intellectual, a truly engaged scholar, a truly practical activist, a wonk for social change. Please join us. Please join me in welcoming this distinguished scholar and leader.
Thanks, David. That was way too nice. It was useful as a reminder to take the long poem down off the internet. So, but I forgot about that. That was embarrassing. But it's very nice to be here, and this is a great time to be talking about the future of democracy and how we keep the movement going after November 5th. We just had dinner with a group of Bates students who started off by listing the various ways that they were engaged, and the list was about 65 different ways that they were engaged for about 8 or 10 students. So there's obviously a lot going on here, and actually part of what I want to do is direct your attention away from here, because I suspect things are going fine here. But in the bigger country, there's some problems. One of the things that Circle does is actually very simple-minded and easy, but it gets us some attention, which is we calculate the voter turnout after each election. And so do other people, but we do it really fast. We do it the day of the election, so we get in the news cycle. And that is interesting because it also gets us into dialogue with reporters who want to know what's happening with the youth turnout. So let me tell you what's happening with youth turnout. You probably know this anyway, but this was a remarkable primary season. Young people voted at about twice the rate they had in 2000, so a doubling of the turnout. And apart from that, there's either statistics or anecdotes will tell you, and you know it from Bates, that young people are talking about the election at remarkably high levels, often persuading someone else to vote for a particular candidate, but talking about it in lots of ways. Watching videos and speeches online at a remarkable rate, millions of downloads of fairly long speeches on YouTube, for example. Also, friending politicians. Barack Obama makes us all jealous by having a million Facebook friends, which he surpassed some time ago. And so those, I mentioned those because some of those ways of participating, we can't even say they're up because they didn't exist in the past. People ask, reporters ask in particular, why this increase? And I've kind of boiled it down to because the kids and the candidates are different than they were before, and I apologize for kids, young adults, but you know, kids alliterates, so I'm going to keep saying it. Kids and the candidates. The young people, the young adults are different, and the difference didn't start in 2008. The difference has been visible for several years. The 2004 turnout, for example, was higher by quite a bit for young people than it had been before. And young people, the millennials in this room, are volunteering and doing community service at rates considerably higher than their parents. So this is just the statistics say this is an engaged generation, at least compared to the generation that preceded it, the Generation Xers. And getting a little bit more kind of qualitative, when we talked to almost 400 college students last year, it was almost 2 years ago, 18 months ago, before the election season started on campuses across the country, we found almost everyone in what was supposed to be a random sample involved in some kind of some kind of volunteer service on an issue, doing something on an issue, and caring about a range of issues, an enormous range of issues, from global warming to parking costs at their own college. And not necessarily by any means committed to participating in formal politics like voting, but definitely open to it and interested in it and toying with these were focus groups, and often they turned into discussions about whether or not voting was important, and people had lots of views, but they'd obviously been thinking about it already, and they were obviously going to be attentive to what politicians said about whether voting would matter. And so that brings us to the candidates, and I think the candidates are generally doing a better job of actually trying to make the case. First of all, if you've got millions of especially college students who are idealistic, motivated by issues, trying to make a difference, then an optimistic, problem-solving kind of rhetoric is appropriate. And that's partly why I think Barack Obama got so many votes. I'm going to talk about how it's not just about Barack Obama in a few minutes, but he does have a rhetorical style that's perfect for that group of students. Also, his biography resonates, I think, very well because the community organizing, community service kind of work is work that many young people can remember themselves doing. But also, leaving aside what Obama's doing and leaving aside all this high-flown idealistic stuff, there's also a change in the nuts and bolts. In the 80s and 90s, political consultants and candidates and campaigns were convinced that it was pointless to invest in trying to mobilize young people. So one of the mechanical things you do in a campaign, as some of you know from hands-on experience, is you have target lists of people you're going to call or visit. And you're always going to choose who to contact because you can't contact everybody. And they would deliberately and very routinely screen the list for age, and they would just drop you if you were under 25. So there was and that was just an example. They also didn't advertise on television that was likely to reach young people. And so you got a real vicious circle. Young people not mobilized and young people not therefore feeling a voice and therefore not voting and therefore not being mobilized again. And at one point, the under 25s reached just 8% of voters. It's kind of a trivial number. But I think that's really changed, partly simply because of the closeness of these elections and the feeling that you can't leave any votes on the table, and partly because of some evidence that we were actually involved in it to a degree, that if you do reach young people, if you do contact them, they will vote. So there's been a much more virtuous cycle of late in which candidates have been trying to mobilize young people and young people have been responding. And you could see this in the fact that several candidates have fairly empowered youth directors. They made appearances on college campuses. I was still at University of Maryland in the spring, and we had Huckabee, Chelsea Clinton, and Barack Obama on our campus, which was unprecedented. So they're reaching out. So the positive interplay between kids and candidates is helping. Reporters are asking us a lot, what are the candidates doing to reach young people online that's effective? And first of all, you probably know better than I do. They're obviously doing some things, and there were some gimmicky things that may or may not have been effective, like texting everybody the name of the vice presidential choice, which we received in my household at 3 a.m, and it was a little annoying. But I think that basically that's the wrong question. What are candidates doing to reach young people online? The whole thing about online, and it's very important fact, goes way beyond this election, is that it's much less about what candidates do anyway. So take the Obama Facebook page. First of all, I don't think it's better than other people's Facebook page, yet it has a million friends. So that has to do much less with creating a good Facebook page than it has with being with what young people are doing. Not everybody who friends them is young, but it's much more about what people out there are doing using the internet than it is about what candidates are doing. That's the whole difference between broadcast medium and the internet, is that with broadcast you have to construct a carefully constructed TV piece. With the internet, it's viral and it's out of your control, for both better and for worse. The other fact about the Obama Facebook page is that his campaign didn't create it in the first place at all. If I understand the story right, it was created by completely independent college students in Northern Virginia, and they ended up giving it to him. So it's just a perfect illustration of how the campaign doesn't control the storyline the way it used to. I keep using Obama, but I do want to say it's not all about Obama. First of all, the turnout increase started in 2004 and was very significant then, and he was a state senator. But also, there are other examples. Mike Huckabee is a very good one. He won the Iowa caucuses on the basis of deliberately mobilizing and successfully mobilizing young evangelicals there. And also, Obama didn't get the majority of young voters in the primaries. He got the largest number of Democratic young voters, but between the Clinton and other Democrats and then those who voted in the Republican primary, he got less than half. All right, so that was sort of a little warm-up. I wanted to talk about these youth turnout increase and this interest in politics. I now want to say that an increase in politics, in particularly in voting, is a good thing. It's a good thing, and we were talking about this a little at dinner, and it's obviously not obvious that it's a good thing. Why should it be a good thing? Let me give you a few reasons. First of all, I think it's a sign or a symptom that young people are involved in other ways that go beyond voting. Because we know from research that voting doesn't usually stand on its own. people who vote don't just vote. Generally speaking, it goes along with things like following the news, caring about social issues, talking about politics, belonging to groups. So if voting goes up, then probably other forms of participation are going up too, underneath that. And what I want to say, first of all, is something that frankly doesn't apply as much directly to students like Bates students, but I think it's very important from a national point of view. That is that those forms of participation are good, are actually good for young people. Not for democracy, not for politics, they're actually good for young people. There's a lot of very strong evidence that shows that when teenagers especially, and young adults, especially teenagers, are engaged with social institutions, members of groups, members of groups that might have a political side to them, they are more likely to stay in school, more likely to flourish in life, more likely to stay out of trouble, out of prison, for example. And that's consistent with a psychological theory that I wonder if anyone's heard of. I only heard of a few years ago, but is now very influential in my mind, of positive youth development. Any nods, nodding heads? Yeah, a few. So, well, Fran doesn't count. Positive youth development says that if you want young people to thrive, if you want young people to thrive in life, you have to give them opportunities to contribute to someone else. It's not effective to treat them as we usually do, or often do, which is as a bundle of problems or potential problems or risks. When we do that, what we then obviously do is test, assess, survey, treat, prevent, and discipline kids. And, you know, obviously you need to do some of that, but when you do nothing but that over and over again for whole categories of kids, the cumulative message is that you think they are crises waiting to happen. And that means they don't have any purpose or value. And human beings really desperately need a sense of purpose and value. So we have found, not we personally, but the research has shown, that when you provide kids with programs that we would normally call service programs or activism programs in high school, they do considerably better in school. And this is, sounds a little romantic and a little soft, but there are very tight, careful studies which, for example, have found that you can cut the pregnancy rate for young teenagers by giving them service opportunities without even talking about sexuality and pregnancy. So I've gone deliberately a little off on a tangent because I don't think voting, we started with voting, I don't think voting itself is likely to be a much of a positive developmental opportunity. It's not like if you could get some kid who was at risk of going to prison and get him in the ballot booth, he's going to be okay. As I said, the rise in voting is a sign or a symptom of greater youth engagement. But it does go along with, and it's important to say, the things that everybody's in a panic about with regard to teenagers are for the most part actually getting at least modestly better and have been for some 10 years or so. So what people are in a panic about is crime, teen crime, violence, weapon possession, pregnancy, drug use. And those things are actually at least somewhat better than they were, and they have been getting better just as people have been more likely to participate, young people have been more likely to participate in politics. And I don't think it's coincidental. But what I've said so far is a very kind of non-political response to this rise in turnout. I actually think it's pretty important, and we spend a lot of time trying to make the case for positive youth development, but it is a little strange because voting is obviously a political act, and here I am saying that it's a way to reduce teen pregnancy. So let me get back to politics. Why would voting be important? Why would voting be a good thing politically? I mean, one very obvious reason is that youth voting is important because youth have different interests than other people and need to be represented. Their interests need to be represented. It's an obvious point, but I'll just try to dramatize it a little. I mean, we all recognize that Social Security gets tremendous amount of attention from politicians, and indeed there's a very narrow range of opinion that politicians can have about Social Security because they all know that older people vote at very high rates. But there are other issues like college affordability that tend to get much less attention. But here's one that is almost completely ignored. When I last was able to get up-to-date data, which was several months ago, the unemployment rate for ages 16 to 19, the sort of teen unemployment rate, was 18%, whereas the unemployment rate for people 25 and older was less than 4%. So unemployment in the United States is overwhelmingly a teenage issue. And yet I don't think you ever hear candidates talk about it that way. And I don't think you ever hear solutions to the unemployment rate that are teen-focused. And it's partly because they don't expect the teens to vote, the older teens to vote. So that's a second kind of reason. I said to caricature the position that youth voting will cut teen pregnancy, which is not really true, but is a sort of shorthand for this positive youth development idea. And then also, young people need to simply express their interests so that they're represented fairly. But more important than those two, we really need to tap diverse range of young people's energies if we're going to address our national challenges, and especially the challenges that involve young people themselves. So, you know, my list of national challenges might be a little different from yours. I'm not assuming anything, but my list would probably be the high school dropout rate of a third of young Americans are not finishing high school, enormous federal deficit that just got $700 billion bigger after I wrote this page, homeland security threats, global warming. As I say, your list might be a little different, but we all agree that the country must deal with complex and serious problems. America has never overcome any major challenge without unleashing the skills, energies, and passions of millions of our citizens. Collaboration is the genius of American democracy. But collaboration and problem solving are in decline, and we can document this. People are substantially less likely to work on community projects than they were 30 years ago. They're less likely to attend meetings than they were 30 years ago. And the decline is not even across the whole population. The decline is basically driven by a decline in how working class people, which I usually define as people without any college experience at all, how they engage in the communities where they live. People without college experience have virtually disappeared from our nation's meetings and groups. But we need all our people to participate in local problem solving, especially in the places which have the most grievous problems. And we need young people to participate, especially on the problems that have a very strong youth aspect. So if we're ever going to understand what drives a third of our kids out of high school before they complete high school, we're obviously going to need high school students themselves to be part of the solution. But more broadly, if we want to reverse this decline, these serious declines in problem solving and working together and joining groups, we're going to have to focus on youth. It's very hard to think of programs or projects or even social movements that have very effectively changed passive adults into active citizens. But it's very easy to find. There's a gigantic stack of studies that find programs, including pretty ordinary and not terribly expensive programs, that have turned fairly passive young adolescents into active citizens and kept them that way for their life course. So returning to voting, I want to say it's only one way to address public problems. It's only a tiny part of, let's say, trying to take on the high school dropout issue through voting. It's part of the package, not the be-all and end-all. But if young people are not voting in a large scale, chances are they're not finding other ways to address serious public problems. It's possible that some of them are deliberately opting out of voting and choosing instead to participate in social movements or those kinds of things. Statistically, however, it's not very likely. So a decline in youth voting is probably a pretty good symptom that young people are kind of dropping out as being part of the solution. But as I said, young people are more involved in this election, and that's a good thing. So can we relax? Well, obviously not, or I wouldn't have more paper here. So let me say why we can't relax. First of all, youth participation is very uneven. And the turnout in the primary gave us an opportunity to sort of dramatize that for the press. College students voted at about a 25% rate. One in four college students and college graduates, young college graduates, voted in this primary season. Of non-college youth, about 1 in 14 voted. So for young people who had never been in college, who had no college experience, virtually none of them voted, 1 in 14. And yet the non-college youth represent half the population. So this is not some small marginal group. It's half the population. And those class differences, because I think of going to college or not basically as a marker of social class, those differences are severe, and they're worse than they were 20 years ago. And they're not just for voting. We also see the same gaps and the same divergence between college-educated and non-college when we look at volunteering, joining groups, attending meetings, working on community projects. Part of the reason is that it's harder to reach young adults in the workforce than to reach college students. If you want to mobilize Bates students, you're all here on campus. If you want to reach Lewiston 20-year-olds who are working in the private sector, it's very hard to reach them. And that's gotten worse. Lewiston is actually a great illustration of this, because I take it 30 or 40 years ago, you could have reached an awful lot of high school graduates by going down to a few buildings downtown where they were all working in mills, besides which they were all in unions, and many of them were probably in Catholic churches. And at this point, they're much more likely to be all over the area working in strip malls, pizza restaurants, et cetera, and it's very hard to reach them. And that's a problem that I don't think there's likely to be much of a solution for. Certainly, it's if you're a campaign, you have X dollars to spend, you're probably going to keep spending them at Bates and not in Lewiston for the foreseeable future. But we do make matters much worse than we have to, because we reserve almost all of the opportunities that would help people to participate in politics during the high school years for those who are heading to college. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but there's a remarkable gap in the opportunities that we offer depending on your future. So we know that things like student government and school newspaper and discussions of current events in social studies classes and field trips and visits from community leaders, we know from pretty solid research those things make you much more interested in and engaged in politics. And we also know that if you are on track to college, you're much more likely to get those experiences. It happens in two levels. Within a school, typically the college, if there's some school, typical American school, where some people are going to college and some people are not, the student government, the school newspaper, the interactive social studies class, the field trip, the trip to Washington or the state capitol are all for college-bound kids. And then if you take two schools, one of which is an excellent or just privileged school, but a school that's sending its kids to selective private universities, everybody's getting those opportunities. And if you go to a school or a whole school system, which is a dropout factory, you'll find very few of those opportunities. And that seems terribly unfair, because politics is one thing that's supposed to be equal, one person, one vote. And if we know that we can provide a base for political engagement for the rest of your life in high school, and we reserve it for exactly the people who need it least, we are being very undemocratic. There are other gaps besides that one. While we're talking about turnout, there's an enormous difference in turnout by state. Minnesota typically has a youth turnout rate double that of Mississippi. And that's a good illustration to shake your view, if you have it at all, that what we're talking about is youth. Because, you know, the youth in Minnesota and the youth in Mississippi are behaving in an entirely different way. So this is not all about a generation. And it's certainly not all about what's inside people's heads, your heads if you're young. It's not all about your motivations or knowledge or whatever. It's also about the political system. Political system is very different in Minnesota from Mississippi. And we could talk about that for a long time. It's got more competitive elections. It's got a different state political system. And so I like to emphasize that because I and people like Patrick Phillips work mostly in civic education in the K-12, in the high school area. Too often we think of civic education as teaching people to participate. But if the system that we're teaching them to participate in is at best very various and at worst very messed up, then I think just teaching them to participate is propaganda. We have to teach them possibly how to change the system. But we can't diagnose the problem as being just inside their head. While we're talking about disparities, there are also big differences in opinion about the current election. So when we polled in July, a national sample, we found about 21% of Americans saying they were excited about and energized by the election, but double that number saying they were frustrated. The frustrated group was very heterogeneous. I think it was sort of Hillary Clinton supporters who were very disappointed that Barack Obama had won, and Barack Obama supporters who were very mad that McCain was beating up on him, and McCain supporters who were couldn't believe that Obama might win. So it was a heterogeneous group, but it was a big group, much bigger than the excited group. So if we're imagining for a minute that everybody's thrilled about this election, well, the people who are frustrated are double the number of the people who are excited. And the young are more excited than any other age group, but I still think if I remember correctly, the frustrated among young people outnumbered the excited. But the main reason we can't relax is because there's no reason to think that engagement with an election will automatically translate into engagement after the election. I mean, I well remember being fairly young myself at the time, 1992, when youth turnout went way up. And it wasn't just turnout. There was lots of youth excitement and dialogue and everything about the election. That was George Bush the first versus Clinton versus Perot. And yet, the following decade was a decade of low and declining youth voting, but also most other forms of engagement slipped in that decade, except for volunteering. So there's, and you know, voting goes up and down depending on the election. It goes up and down depending on the candidates and how competitive things are and how the media covers it. Things like group membership and participation in clubs and meetings, these things tend to move one percentage point at a time. And in the last 30 years, those have been downward trends. They move because of deep changes in the economy and society and technology, and we're not going to solve those with an election. I can also tell you that when we asked in July a national sample of people whether they thought they were going to be involved with issues that were important to them during the election, after the election, and we gave them a bunch of ways they might be involved, like contacting elected officials or working to change policies in your own school or community or workplace, we got fairly low levels of response. And that's particularly disturbing because that's exactly the kind of question that all of us answer more positively than the truth. So in other words, if I'm asked, am I going to contact an official, I'm probably going to say yes, and I'm probably not actually going to contact the official. But even asking the question that way, we got fairly low responses. So it's not going to carry over automatically. November 4th is election day. November 5th, the day after. As my colleague David Smith says, we don't want that to be Black Wednesday for the civic engagement movement when the level of civic engagement falls off the cliff, but it may happen. One thing we can be happy about is Americans are philosophically in favor of civic engagement. If you ask them whether they think that it takes the kind of stuff I've been saying, that it takes Americans to work together, working together to solve problems, whether the government can solve problems by itself or whether we need active engagement, whether we need everybody, you get very positive responses. If you ask people whether it's their own duty to participate, you get very positive responses. But you don't get automatic engagement. And that shouldn't be surprising. I mean, that's just like lots of other phenomena. People will say that they think we should cut carbon emissions, for example, but they won't rush out and buy the lowest emitting car. And you can debate this. I'd be happy to have you all debate it later. Why this is it hypocrisy, or is it that we need different incentives and structures and taxes and things like that? But it's a very common phenomenon, and we're seeing it in this case as we see in so many others, that people are very much in favor of civic engagement, but not likely to just produce it on large scale on their own. I have some things to say about schools. I think I'll skip them. Because I don't think too many people except my two good friends in the back are going to be that interested in what schools should do. Although I will say, when I do talk to school teachers, one of my main points is that we need to make sure that teachers can be safe and supported in discussing, in having current events discussions in the classroom, because that's something that we know carries over. And the kids are all talking about the election right now. We need to make sure that that happens actually in the classroom as well as just in the hallways and that it can continue. But for other citizens, let's stick to that. For citizens who are older than high school and who are out in the world, what we need is policies to institutionalize and support civic engagement between elections and throughout the whole lifespan. And fortunately, there's quite a lot of public support for some of these key policies. So in the survey that I keep alluding to and which was released on Monday, we asked about a bunch of policies, and I want to mention some of these. One of them was the idea of making it possible for any young American to earn college tuition or salary for doing a year of national community service. That would mean working for the Peace Corps or VISTA or City or Youth Builder, a whole bunch of other organizations that are partially funded by the government. And it would mean a massive expansion of those programs because they don't by any means provide every American with an opportunity. They're some of them extremely competitive. And there was overwhelming bipartisan support for that idea in the poll. I won't throw lots of statistics around, but the numbers were in the 90s for support. And there were Republicans as well as Democrats. And as we saw on September 11th, both national presidential candidates took time out on an extremely important, tactically important moment in the election on September 11th, went to New York City, and endorsed a bill which would dramatically expand those opportunities. That the bill, by the way, is also co-sponsored by Senator Kennedy and Senator Hatch, which is an extremely powerful duo. So I think it'll probably pass. Parenthetically, the question is not whether it will pass, but whether it will be funded, because with a $700 billion hole in the federal deficit, I'm not sure, federal budget, I'm not sure they can afford to fund anything. But I think that probably the National Community Service programs, the AmeriCorps programs, will expand. Whether that's going to address any of the things I've been talking about so far depends a lot on what young people will be asked to do when they participate in these programs. Providing direct hands-on service is okay, but it's a lot like a regular job, and I'm not sure it would get you the political advantages or the health advantages or any of the other advantages that I mentioned. So it's important for these national community service programs to involve real aspects of leadership and collaboration and problem solving. I think we have at least one VISTA in the room, right? Or do we? Maybe not. America? Did you? You previously a VISTA, so we have at least one. So you can talk about that. I'll make you talk about that after. But there's a very great range in the programs that are actually provided. So, you know, I like, just as an illustrative example, the Peace Corps has a nice little kind of computer game on their website for recruiting purposes. You're a Peace Corps volunteer, so you go into a developing country, into a village, and they have big problems with their water supply, the safety of their water supply, and you have to solve that problem by talking to various stakeholders, doing research, organizing people. And that's probably, I guess, a fairly reasonable description of a real Peace Corps volunteer's job, and it's exactly what I have been trying to talk about tonight, about what we need. But there are a lot of other programs where you're basically loading a bunch of kids up on the bus and shipping them off to some place to paint the wall. So we have to make sure that not only the number of national community service programs enlarges, but also the quality of the work that the young people do improves. Here's another policy idea. There's strong support for more public deliberation. An organization that I sit on the board of called America Speaks has a program called, has a proposal, not a real program yet, called Millions of Voices. And under Millions of Voices, Congress would every year, or every 2 years, pick an important issue. So they might pick the financial meltdown now, or global warming, or something like that, and announce there was going to be a public deliberation. And there would be a strategy for getting up at least 1 million Americans involved in discussions on the issue, informed by background materials produced in a bipartisan basis. And then the opinions that they got to after discussing would be harvested. And Congress would be required not to pass the law that they supported, but to hold hearings on the proposals. And that idea was overwhelmingly popular among the people we polled. So it's a very popular idea. John Edwards actually endorsed it in the primary campaign, then dropped out. So it's sitting there waiting for somebody to pick up. The public was actually also very supportive of civic education in high schools and of service learning. They, in fact, in order to, so you all know what service learning is, right? We actually, to prevent people from answering the question just very easily, yes, we said, should service learning be required for everyone for high school graduation? And there was an overwhelming support for that. In my opinion, these special opportunities, so national community service, civic education, service learning, this annual deliberation, are important, and they're important for a lot of reasons, including maybe in some ways a symbolic reason. But they can't be allowed to stand alone. They're not sufficient. It's not enough for us to say that if you're not voting, working full-time for an AmeriCorps program, you know, in Yura Vista, or attending a deliberation, there's nothing for you. I would like to see us restructure our regular programs and institutions so that they encourage more civic engagement. And an example of this would be would be education, which I think there are equally good examples in environment and other areas, police. But I'll mention education. The most powerful policy we have today, as you all know, in education is No Child Left Behind. And it's very controversial, and we could argue pros and cons all day. But one thing it's clearly done is it's centralized control over our schools, because it's made tests very influential. And the tests are standardized. They're called standardized tests. And what that means is that a fairly small number of people are empowered. So they're people mostly places like the Educational Testing Service in Princeton, which writes these tests. That means that that local communities have a lot less influence on what is taught in their schools and how it's taught. And so all kinds of value judgments and decisions about priorities can't be made at the local level the way they used to be able to. And so citizen involvement in schools is less influential, less meaningful, less impactful than it used to be. And in fact, I think that's part of the reason. No Child Left Behind only caps a long trend of at least 25 years of kind of centralization and professionalization of education. And during those 30 years, parent and other community involvement in schools has been falling, as measured by things like PTA membership. I don't know if that's the only reason. I think there are other reasons too, but it's definitely true that that both fewer people are involved in working with schools and that their influence on schools is smaller. Now, I mention this partly because we actually asked a survey question about that. We said, would you favor, we phrase it better than I'm about to, but would you favor changing federal law so that local communities had more control over schools and tests were less important? And we got a very split verdict on that. I think a majority was in favor, but a big minority was against. And it very much correlated with education. The more educated you were, the more against. So I think when it comes to education and also to probably to environment and police and a lot of other things, we basically have a fairly large, well-educated, powerful group. I mean, not a special elite, but a large, well-educated population, which is quite comfortable, actually, with a reduction in the amount of civic and political engagement, which is probably, in my guess, worried about school systems teaching creationism, worried about school systems school systems teaching Afrocentrism, worried about a lot of things sort of on the margins and quite comfortable with the Educational Testing Service determining what success in schools. Education is only one example, and my idea of decentralizing might not even be a good one. We could definitely debate it, pros and cons. But what I would say is that if we want to increase the citizens' role in our public life, we're going to have to rethink not just these special opportunities, but the day-to-day institutions, which include schools. And we're going to have to make tough choices. For example, I personally would be quite comfortable with some schools teaching creationism, which I think is wrong, and myself. But I'd be quite willing to pay that price in order to get more citizen engagement. Anyway, that's something to be discussed. But let me end by suggesting why civic engagement is important anyway, and just in a way sort of wrapping up with that. At its core, most importantly, civic engagement is an alternative to politics as we know it. It's an alternative to politics as we know it. So when you look at the kind of programs that come out of the Harwood Center, good examples of service learning or youth-led research or youth media production and youth theater and deliberation of current events, these things are profoundly countercultural. They exemplify a kind of politics that is desperately short supply today. In general, as I've said, we treat young people as baskets of problems or potential problems. These civic engagement programs embody the alternative approach of positive youth development, which treats young people as assets. In general, we see education as the job of teachers and principals in schools, whether public or private. So it's a specialized task to be measured by experts. And then success inevitably boils down to passing tests. But education should be a community-wide function, the process by which a whole community chooses and transmits to the next generation values, traditions, skills, practices, and cultural norms. The civic engagement programs, like those at Bates, cross the lines between schools and communities and reflect a more inclusive definition in which everybody's educating. In general, our politics is constrained by the fact that investments can quickly be moved away from communities that decide to impose regulations that businesses don't like. So you can't raise taxes without the mill disappearing, if it's not going to disappear anyway. But schools and colleges are important economic institutions that are rooted in their communities and dependent on them. Bates, we were talking about this in the car, can't leave Lewiston. It's here. And so if Bates is engaged, it has a kind of accountability and connection to the community here that it can't escape, and that's rare. In general, our politics is government-centered. The liberals want the government to accept new tasks like health insurance. Conservatives believe that a problem would be solved if government did less. I say to you that governments are important, but they're not by any means the only institutions that matter. And a government-centered view leaves citizens little to do but inform themselves and then vote every couple of years. Youth civic engagement at its best epitomizes a citizen-centered politics in which people form relationships with peers, express their interests, listen to others, and then use a range of strategies, some having little to do with the government. So I'm not arguing that the strategies that involve the government are worse, but that the choice belongs to citizens. In general, our politics is manipulative. Experts, politicians, pundits, consultants, marketers, leaders of advocacy groups study us, poll us, focus group us, assign us to gerrymandered electoral districts. They slice and dice us, and then they send us tailored messages designed to encourage us or to scare us into acting just how they want. That's true of liberal politicians as well as conservative ones. It's true of public interest lobbies as well as business lobbies. It's true of big nonprofits as well as political parties. It's true of many of the civic groups in kind of my small business, David's. For example, it's true of my organization. We've been part of the movement to increase youth voter turnout. And part of what we've done for that is to, a part of our contribution has been to make techniques for getting young people to vote more sophisticated and effective. Back in the 1990s, if you wanted young people to vote, you'd come up with a message and mail it to people and hope that they voted. Now, routinely, you come up with three or four different messages and you test them on randomly selected groups of young people and you figure out which message worked most effectively at actually raising turnout, not just at what they said. And very often, the messages that seemed to the hip young people who designed them to be the best or that came off in the best in the focus group don't do the best in the experiment. And so our messages have gotten more and more sophisticated. And that's just an example of the growing efficiency in the whole public interest nonpartisan world, which is nothing compared to the efficiency in either the commercial sector or partisan politics. But, and I think I'm going to keep being part of it, because if you do want some of the things that I've been talking about before, and you're in a very competitive environment, you may just have to be as efficient as you possibly can, which is why we did a survey, which we released early this week, trying to figure out what kind of policies people would resonate to. But I do think that overall, Americans know they're being manipulated, and they resent it. They want to be able to decide for themselves what is important, what should be done, and then act in common to address their problems. They're interested in what other people think. They want to get out of what college students call their bubbles. They want an open-ended, citizen-centered politics in which the outcomes are not predetermined by professionals. And civic engagement at its best is open-ended politics. We don't try to manipulate, we shouldn't try to manipulate our students or our neighbors into adopting opinions or solutions that we think are right. We give them opportunities to deliberate and reflect and then act in ways that seem best to them. In a time of increasingly sophisticated, manipulative politics, those opportunities are precious. I'll stop by just saying those are the opportunities you offer, so I'm delighted to have been here to talk about them. Thanks.